Okay, back to Daniel chapter 9. Just to summarize, it's a prophecy that comes into being out of Daniel's misunderstanding. He correctly understood that the captivity would last for 70 years. So the time that he has this experience, the captivity is only about 3 years to go or so. But he made the assumption that the end of the captivity will come to the Messianic kingdom and acts as if he anticipates it being set up, and that's where he misunderstood the prophecy, and so Gabriel was sent to Daniel to clarify things. As Daniel's book so far throughout his writings has been on the times of the Gentiles, he's now told there's going to be a 490-year period that's cut out of the times of the Gentiles that will be affecting specifically Jewish history. And listed the six different purposes of the 77s in verse 24. Now again, the 77s are divided into three divisions. You have the 77s, followed by 62 sevens, followed by 1 seven. Then the 1 seven itself will be divided into two equal parts. But verse 25, he tells them what will be the starting point. In verse 25, no different discern than from going forth of the commandment to restore and to build Jerusalem unto Messiah the Prince. The starting point then is the decree being issued for the purpose of rebuilding and restoring Jerusalem. And then from that point, count the 483 years, we shall see, Messiah should appear, should be here. But it's a decree that involves the rebuilding of Jerusalem, so this should not come down to is the real problem. What decree is he referring to? Over the years, different Bible teachers have come up with four different options. The first one is the decree of Cyrus, the Emperor Persia, which was issued in the year 538-537 BC. And Cyrus was the one Isaiah prophesied by name would do so. And this is the decree that you'll find in four key passages, 2 Chronicles chapter 36, verses 22 and 23, 2 Chronicles 36, verses 22 and 23. The second time is Ezra chapter 1, verses 1 through 4, Ezra 1, verses 1 through 4, and chapter 6, verses 1 through 5, chapter 6, verses 1 through 5. The special focus is on the rebuilding of the temple building. That's the special focus of this decree. A second option that some people hold to is the decree of Darius, D-A-R-I-U-S, D-A-R-I-U-S, Darius Hystaspes, H-Y-S-T-A-S-P-E-S, H-Y-S-T-A-S-P-E-S, issued in the year 521 B.C., 521. That's the one mentioned in Ezra chapter 6, verses 6 to 12, Ezra 6, 6 to 12. But this is merely a reaffirmation of the Cyrus decree, a reaffirmation of the Cyrus decree. The Jews were forced to stop for a while, but then when Darius became emperor, they asked him to check the records, and he found it. It also focuses on the same thing Cyrus wrote about, which is to rebuilding of the temple. The third option is the decree of Artaxerxes to Ezra. The decree of Artaxerxes, that's spelled A-R-T-A-X-E-R-X-E-S, A-R-T-A-X-E-R-X-E-S, specifically to Ezra in the year 458 BC. And that was mentioned Ezra chapter 7, verses 11 through 26, Ezra 7, 11 through 26. You have the fourth one, the decree of Artaxerxes to Nehemiah. The decree of Artaxerxes to Nehemiah, which was issued in the year 444 BC. 444. The one mentioned Nehemiah chapter 2, verses 1 through 8. Nehemiah 2, verses 1 through 8. It concerns the rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem. Now, these are the four options, but the only two of these have any real validity, number one and number four. Now, all four of these decrees did contribute to the rebuilding of Jerusalem. All four of them provided the opportunity. But as far as trying to determine when the 77th begins, you have only those two options, Cyrus or the Artaxerxes decree to Nehemiah. Now, I'm not going to get into all of the different issues involved and how to deal with them because that would take much more time. It'll probably be helpful to have some kind of a chalkboard to figure this out. Let me just give you a good defense of each of these two views, and you can search them out. Now, Sir Robert Anderson wrote a book entitled "The Coming Prince." The Coming Prince. And he determined the decree this is referring to is the decree about the Xerxes to Nehemiah. So he made his calculations, ended up with a crucifixion in AD 32. With crucifixion in AD 32, concluding the 77s with the triumphal ride to Jerusalem on the donkey. He made a small error because he put the decree in 445 and it came out in 444. So a professor that I had in Dallas Seminary named Harold Horner, H-O-R-N-E-R, H-O-R-N-E-R, put together a book called Chronological Issues in the Life of Christ, The Chronological Issues in the Life of Christ. And he devotes a chapter. He agreed with Sir Robert Anderson, but corrected his dates. So he concluded with a 33 AD crucifixion. And so the 77s begins with the decree of Artaxerxes in 444 BC. And concludes in AD 33 on the day he rode to Jerusalem on the donkey. So for defense of this date, I recommend you read the Horner's work. But nothing in this passage requires the first 69 sevens to end with the triumphal entry. And furthermore, if you read Nehemiah chapter 2, verses 1 through 8, you don't really see a decree there. It gives the Nehemiah to rebuild the wall. But it's not an official decree. And furthermore, rebuilding the wall is not the same as rebuilding the city. And the decree notice here requires the rebuilding of the city, not merely the wall. Now, the other option is the one I prefer, the decree of Cyrus. This is a real decree. It's the one given within 3 years, the time that Daniel receives the vision he receives. And this is the decree that is particularly emphasized elsewhere in Scripture. For example, as we mentioned earlier, it's the decree mentioned specifically by Isaiah the prophet 2 centuries before the time of Cyrus, and even mentions Cyrus by name. And again, this is Isaiah chapter 44, verses 24 through 28. Isaiah 44, 24 to 28, and chapter 45, verses 1 and 13. 45 verses 1 and 13. And although the decree as listed in the Chronicles, Ezra passages I gave you, does not mention the building of the city, we know from Isaiah's prophecy would include the rebuilding of the city. And we see this in Isaiah chapter 44, verse 28, 44, 28, and 45, 13, 45, 13. It's also obvious from Nehemiah's book, the Jews had rebuilt the city before Nehemiah came to repair the wall. So in Haggai chapter 1, verses 2 through 4, Haggai 1, verses 2 through 4, 7 years before Nehemiah arrives, the Jews are already living in homes in Jerusalem. The city was well rebuilt before Nehemiah arrives. We see this in Ezra chapter 4, verses 7 through 16, Ezra 4, 7 through 16, Ezra chapter 5, verse 3, Ezra chapter 5, verse 3. And the issue boils down to, because the modern days do not quite fit into this kind of prophecy, but the issue comes down to certain problems with Persian chronology. Persian chronology, where some kings listed as separately, were actually the same person with different titles. And the best work on defending the decree of Cyrus, and again, that's the decree I prefer, is a work by a person named David L. Cooper, C-O-O-P-E-R, C-O-O-P-R, David L. Cooper. It's found in a larger work called Messiah, His First Coming Scheduled. Messiah, His First Coming Scheduled. It's also found in a smaller work dedicated only to this passage, and that book is called The 70 Weeks of Daniel. The 70 Weeks of Daniel. And it will begin with the decree of Cyrus and terminate not with the triumphal entry, but with the birth of the Messiah, which fits better the phrase, unto Messiah the Prince. The first view I mentioned, Artaxerxes' decree is a bit easier to defend, but the second one is harder because of the problems of Persian chronology, but it's doable, and the works by Cooper will show that. But regardless of which decree we go with, what is evident as we move to the prophecy is that it must be fulfilled before the temple is destroyed in AD 70. It must be fulfilled sometime before that. And we'll see why momentarily. Now back to our verse here in verse 25. Note therefore and discern the going forth of the commandment to a stone to build Jerusalem unto the Messiah the Prince shall be 7 sevenths. That's 49 years. Followed by 62 sevenths, that's 434 years. That's broken up the way because the 49 years is how long it took to finally get Jerusalem rebuilt. So it says it shall be built again with street and moat, even in troublous times. So the first subdivision, 7 sevenths, so 49 years, covers the period it took to rebuild Jerusalem. That'll be followed by the 62 sevenths, that's the second subdivision of the 70 sevenths, totaling 434 years. And notice there's no indication of a break of time between the first and second subdivision. No implication, not even a hint, of a break between the 7 sevenths and the 62 sevenths for a total of 69 sevenths. So it shows that the 62 sevenths simply follow the 7 sevenths, which gives a total of 483 years. And he says, unto Messiah the Prince. Again, the phrase would not point to a triumphal entry, just appears to only points to his appearance. And that'd be best to be interpreted by his arrival in his birth. So from the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the arrival of the Prince, the Messiah the Prince, would be exactly 483 years. And again, regardless of which of the two decrees, it does require Messiah to have come before AD 70. Now, while there was no implication of a break of time between the first and second subdivision, it clearly shows there's a break of time between the 69th seven and the 77. Verse 26, And after the 60 and 2 sevens shall the prince be cut off, shall the Messiah be cut off, and shall have nothing. And the people of the prince that shall come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary, and the end of shall be with a flood. Into the end shall desolations be determined. Now notice, following the 69:7, there's a break in which three things occur. Number one, Messiah shall be cut off and have nothing. The word cut off means to be killed, but it's a legal, meaning a legal execution, often used in the Mosaic law. This or that person shall be cut off among his people because of some act of disobedience. So Messiah suffers a death, but it's a legal execution. Not a justified execution, but a legal one. And that would occur roughly about 35 years after Messiah was born. I hold to a 30 AD crucifixion. He was born between 7 and 6 BC, roughly 35 years after his birth. He was crucified and shall have nothing. The phrase shall have nothing can have two different meanings. It might be taken as a noun, meaning nothingness. Nothingness. That would describe his state at death. Although he died, at this point of time, no messianic kingdom was established. But the same phrase can also mean, but not for himself. He shall be cut off, but not for himself, meaning he doesn't die because of anything he committed. He dies on behalf of others. It could be taken either one way or the other, though if you take the Bible as a whole about these issues, both statements are true. So number one, the Messiah will be cut off in the year AD 30 for some AD 33. A second event will happen in the gap of time between the second and third subdivision is the people of the prince that shall come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary, and the end thereof shall be with a flood. Thus, what he does not say, he does not say the prince that shall come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary, but rather the people out of which the prince that shall come comes out of shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. That the prince that shall come, he's wrote about earlier in chapter 7, again in chapter 8, dealing with the final ruler of the times of Gentiles, the Antichrist. Will not be the Antichrist that will destroy the city and the temple. Rather, it's the people out of which he comes from will destroy the city and the temple. It's now a matter of history who destroyed the city and the temple, and that was the Romans. And that shows you the ethnic identity out of which he will come. The Antichrist would be a Gentile of Roman origin. Because the prince that shall come and the people destroy the city and the temple of the same ethnic identity. And so after the Messiah is cut off, sometime after that, the temple will be destroyed, the city will be destroyed, which happened in the year AD 70. And these events occur in the year 70, which means about 40 years after Messiah's death. That's a second event within the gap of time. He says, the end thereof shall be with a flood. When the word flood is used symbolically, it's always a symbol of military invasion. And the point he makes is that Jerusalem and the temple will be destroyed by military invasion. The military invasion by the Romans, first by Vespasian and later by Titus. But there's a third element in this interval period of time. Even unto the end shall be war. For the remainder of the interval, the land will be characterized by war after war after war, which will set the stage for the last 7 years. He says, desolations are determined. That's the state of the land as a result of all these wars determined, already decreed by God. And as we know from history, any history of the Middle East was shown the land has suffered war after war after war, even after AD 70, even the Second Jewish Revolt. Even since Israel became a state, Israel has had to fight four major wars with Arab states and a good number of the more limited wars against terrorism. And that's not going to change until Messiah returns. Now, when the 77s began, he gave us a sign by which we can know it begins, and that is the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem. And because the second subdivision occurs right after the first subdivision, there was no need for a sign. They'll tell us when the second subdivision begins. It just continues after the first subdivision. Seven sevens immediately followed by the 62 sevens. Only reason for that division is to focus on how long it will take to rebuild Jerusalem. But because he points out there's a gap of time between the 69th seven and the 77, where three things occur, we now need to know what will be the event that will signal the last 7 years of the times of the Gentiles, the last 7 years of this prophetic time clock of Israel. So he provides the sign in verse 27. He shall make a firm covenant with many for 1 7. The pronoun he goes back to his nearest antecedent, which is the prince that shall come, in verse 26. In other words, the prince that shall come in verse 26 and the he who makes a covenant in verse 27 is the same individual. In our circles, simply called the Antichrist today. And so the last 7 years begin with the signing of a specific covenant between Israel and the Antichrist. Now, this presupposes two things will occur before this can happen. One has occurred, one is yet to occur. First of all, this presupposes that there is a Jewish state with a Jewish government with whom a covenant like this could be signed. And this has been true only as of 1948. The tribulation could not have begun before 1948. There was no one actually signing, there was no Jewish state and Jewish government with whom a covenant like this could be signed. And that is already in place. But the second thing this presupposes is that the Antichrist will be in high political authority with whom a sovereign state like Israel could sign a covenant of this nature. Because sovereign states do not sign covenants with nobodies. And this is not yet in place. Well, it's important to note it's not the rapture of the church that will trigger the tribulation, as is sometimes taught. Rapture will occur sometime before the tribulation. We don't know when before. Maybe just before, maybe 10, 20, 30 years before. We simply don't know. Rapture is an imminent event, can happen any moment of time, and it's not tied into any of these events. So rapture will occur sometime before the signing of the covenant, but how long before? We do not know. Now, this last 7 years also is subdivided into two equal halves. So you'll read about 42 months, because each half is 42 months. Also, you read about 1,260 days, because each part is 1,260 days. You also have a phrase, time times the half a time. All of these are equal to 3.5 years, and there's two different sets of 3.5 years. The verse continues, in the middle of the Sabbath, he will cause the sacrifice and the oblation to cease. And what marks the midpoint is a cessation of the sacrificial system, a forced cessation of the sacrificial system. What this also shows is that by this point of time, the temple is rebuilt and functioning. The temple's rebuilt and functioning. That leaves us with two possible options about the timing of the rebuilding of the temple. On one hand, it may be rebuilt in the first half of the tribulation. That's one option. The second option is it might be rebuilt even before the tribulation starts, so we cannot make it more specific than that. Either it'll be rebuilt in the first half or be rebuilt before the tribulation starts, but what is certain is by the midpoint, it is standing, it is functioning. At the midpoint, there is a forced cessation of the sacrificial system. At that point, the Antichrist will take it over and declare himself to be God from within the Holy Temple. Now, the covenant that triggers it, notice, is made with many, but not with all. And there'll be a segment of the Jewish population, the remnant of Israel of that day that believes, would not go along with the covenant, but the covenant is made with many, the majority, and certainly would have to include the leadership of Israel. Only they have the empowerment to sign a covenant of this nature. And a sign to last for 7 years, but as we now notice, it won't last for 7 years because the midpoint will be broken. What Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes did in history, the Antichrist will do in prophecy. The same event is mentioned by the Messiah himself in Matthew chapter 24, verses 15 and 16. Matthew 24, 15 and 16, also mentioned Revelation 11, verses 1 and 2. Revelation 11, verses 1 and 2. There'll be once again a Gentile retaking of Jerusalem, the old city, and the temple compound. This is, upon the wing of abomination shall come one that makes desolate. The wing of abominations, the wing is the pinnacle of the temple. And the Antichrist will declare himself God from the temple compound. We see this also in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 3 and 4, 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 3 and 4. Now, the word abomination is a term often used of setting up an idol, and we know also the Antichrist set up an image or an idol, an image of the Antichrist himself in the temple compound. We also know from other passages he himself will move to Babylon, that will be his world political headquarters. But there will be an image erected in Revelation 13, verses 14 and 15. Revelation 13, verses 14 and 15. The one who comes to make desolate will be the Antichrist, and he'll cause a desolation upon the Jewish people. In the first half of the tribulation, the Jews suffer no more or no less than anybody else suffers. But in the second half, there'll be a targeting of the Jews for total annihilation. And what will signal the final attempt to annihilate the Jews once and for all is the abomination of desolation. That's the point of time that he'll take over the temple, inaugurate his own deity to be worshipped, but annihilate the Jews as well. And the reason the Jews will be targeted is because of the precondition to the second coming. Because Satan knows that once the Messiah returns, his career is over. He also knows that Jesus does not come back until the Jewish people ask him to come back. Israel's national salvation is the prerequisite to the second coming. The rapture has no prerequisites at all. It could happen even today, but the second coming does have a prerequisite. So Satan can destroy the Jews once and for all before they have a chance to plead for Messiah's return. There'll be no second coming, and Satan's career will be saved forever. That's the reason why he's always had the special war against the Jews since the time of Abraham. That's why things like the Crusades occurred, why the Russian pogroms occurred, why the Nazi Holocaust occurred. And why Revelation chapter 12 points out that once Satan is confined to the earth at the midpoint of tribulation, he knows his time is short. 3.5 years before the second coming, knowing it, he organizes the Antichrist and the false prophet set up a worldwide Nazi-like persecution to annihilate the Jews to avoid the second coming. And then the verse ends, even to full end, and that determined shall not be brought upon the desert, into the full end, to the very completion, the last day of the 77. And so the tribulation will allow to continue beyond the time allotted. And the tribulation will last exactly 7 years, and the period of Jewish persecution lasts exactly 1,260 days. It would not be allowed to go a second beyond that, because if it went beyond that, the Jews might be destroyed in Matthew 24, verse 22. Matthew 24, verse 22. So he says, wrath shall be put out upon the desolate. At the end of that period, the desolation suffered that he put upon the Jewish people, the Antichrist himself will suffer. Let's summarize the points that this passage has made. Number one, the Messiah will be present 483 years after the decree, whether you choose Cyrus or Artaxerxes. Secondly, Messiah will be killed violently in illegal execution. Thirdly, the Messiah's rejection will be the cause of the destruction of the city and the temple. So fourthly, this shows Messiah's death had to come before AD 70. Messiah's death, his coming and death, had to come before AD 70. I mentioned we talk about Balaam's star out of Jacob. That would have consequences all the way to Matthew chapter 2. So does this prophecy. Because the wise men that came to Jerusalem with the question, where is he born, the king of the Jews, came from Babylonia. And they were actually by profession astrologers. Being Gentile and astrologers, how would they have a messianic concept? Now, the book of Daniel, keep in mind, was not written in Israel. It was written in Babylon. And half the book is not Hebrew, which is the Jewish tongue. Half the book is Aramaic, which is the tongue of the Babylonians. And as you read the book of Daniel, especially the events of chapter 2, Daniel happened to save the lives of all the other wise men. In chapter 1, when Nebuchadnezzar examined Daniel and Daniel showed his superiority in wisdom and knowledge over the other wise men, Nebuchadnezzar made him the head of the Babylonian school of astrology. But being a good Jew, Daniel never practiced astrology. He had to learn it by force. He did not practice it. All the information he got came directly from the creator of the stars, the God of Israel. And when the other wise men could not interpret Nebuchadnezzar's dream, he sentenced all the wise men to be executed. Among the ones arrested were included Daniel, but Daniel asked to receive an audience with the king. He interpreted a dream and saved the lives of all the others. And no doubt, as a result, many of these turned away from worshiping the stars, began to worship the creator of the stars, the God of Israel. And now they had in their possession a book written by their former president that gave a timetable for the first coming. And when they saw this unusual light in the heavens, they took that the sign the Messiah has been born. Now keep in mind, in ancient times, the fields of astronomy and astrology were not separate disciplines. If you study one, you study the other. So if anyone would notice a new light up in the heavens, that would be these astrologers from Babylonia. So God used their profession to note a new star, and because of Daniel's prophecy providing the timetable, and because of Balaam's prophecy connecting the Messiah with a star who also came from Babylonia, they took that to be the sign the Messiah has arrived and came to Jerusalem with the question, where is he that is born the king of the Jews? Because what they did not have is Micah's prophecy about the birth being in Bethlehem. But that got rectified from the Jewish leaders that told them about that prophecy. So this passage also had consequences all the way to Matthew chapter 2. Let's look at some other lines of evidence that are not relevant to law, prophets, or writings individually, but very relevant to furthering the concept of first coming prophecies. First of all, the plurality of the Godhead. Why don't you turn to Genesis chapter 1. The famous verse that begins with, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." In the Hebrew text, the word for God is Elohim, E-L-O-H-I-M, E-L-O-H-I-M, which is a plural noun. Not singular, but plural. Literally, the beginning gods created the heavens and the earth. It's a word that is used both of the true God, as here in chapter 1, verse 1, is also true of false gods. For example, the same word is used in Exodus chapter 20, verse 3. Exodus 20, verse 3, "You shall have no other Elohim, have no other gods before me." Deuteronomy chapter 13, verse 2. Deuteronomy chapter 13, verse 2, "Let us go after other Elohim, other gods." There is a singular form of the word. The singular form is Elohar, E-L-O-A-H, E-L-O-A-H. Elohar, the singular, is used only 250 times in the whole Hebrew Bible. Like Habakkuk 3:3. But Elohim is used 2,500 times in the Hebrew Bible. So it has a far greater use of the plural than the singular. And because it is used of the true God, that begins to open the door to a concept of plurality. In Hebrew, the way you can distinguish whether it's used of the true gods or the false gods is whether the verb that follows it or precedes it is singular or plural. So if the word Elohim is used of the false gods, the verb that follows would always be singular, of the false gods always be plural. But if it's used of the true God, it almost always is singular. However, there are four specific occasions where the writer speaks about the true God, but he puts the verb into the plural, not the singular, which is normative. Look at chapter 20, verse 13. Chapter 20, verse 13. "And it came to pass when God caused me to wander from my father's house." And notice the word God is clearly used of the true God. This is Abraham speaking. "Caused me to wander," but that verb is not singular as you would anticipate in the Hebrew text. It is plural. Literally, God, they caused me to wander. God, they caused me to wander. So normally the singular would be used, now and then the plural verb is used, showing a concept of plurality within the Godhead. Look at chapter 35, verse 7. Chapter 35, verse 7. "And he built an altar and called the place El Bethel, because there God was revealed unto him." This is Jacob, this experience with the true God. This is the true God, El, true Elohim. Instead of giving us a singular verb, he gives us a plural verb. "Lily, and they revealed themselves to him." They revealed themselves to him. Look at Samuel chapter 2 Samuel chapter 7. 2 Samuel chapter 7. And verse 23, 2 Samuel 7, verse 23. "And what one nation in the earth is like your people, even like Israel, whom God went to redeem unto himself for a people, to make him a name, and do great things for you," and so on. Notice again the word God is used of the true God, But instead of using the word went in the singular, he uses it in the plural. God, they went. God, they went. And one more example would be Psalm 58. Psalm 58, verse 11. Psalm 58, verse 11. Verse 11 of Psalm 58 says, "Verily there is a God that judges," at the end of verse 11, "verily there is a God," that's the true God, "that judges in the earth." Instead of using the singular verb, use the plural verb. There is a God, Elohim, they judge. So again, normally when Elohim is used to the true God, the verb is singular. But there are these four exceptions, which again shows the concept of opening the door to plurality. Another line of argument is sometimes the word Elohim is applied to two different personalities in the same verse. Look at Psalm 45. Psalm 45. Verse 6, Psalm 45, verse 6. "Your throne, O God, is forever and ever. A scepter of equity is the scepter of your kingdom. You have loved righteousness and hated wickedness. Therefore, God, your God, has anointed you. We're all the gladness above your fellows." Notice he's addressing God and says to God, "Your God has anointed you." Elohim is applied to two distinct personalities. Another example for your notes, you can simply mark down Hosea chapter 1, verse 7. Hosea chapter 1, verse 7. The speaker is called Elohim, and Elohim is saved by Jehovah Elohim. Even more to the point, sometimes God's name, Yahweh, is applied to two different individuals in the same verse. Back to Genesis, and look at chapter 19. Genesis chapter 19. Chapter 19, look at verse 24. Look at verse 24. "Then Jehovah rained upon Sodom and Gomorrah brimstone of fire from Jehovah out of heaven." Notice two Jehovahs. One Jehovah on earth that's been speaking to Abraham rains fire and brimstone from another Jehovah up in heaven. And this is a name that applies only to the true God, Yahweh. And you have the word used of two different personalities within the same verse. Another example you can mark down is Zechariah chapter 2, verses 8 and 9. Zechariah 2, verses 8 and 9. Another line of evidence is that sometimes the plural pronoun is used of the true one God. The Bible virtually begins that way. Look at Genesis chapter 1. Genesis chapter 1. And verse 26, Genesis chapter 1, verse 26. "And God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness." Us make man, our image, our likeness. This is the true God speaking, but he uses the plural pronoun. Look at chapter 3, verse 22. Chapter 3, verse 22. "And Jehovah God said, behold, the man is become as one of us, to know good and evil." Again, God refers to himself in the plural pronoun. Look at chapter 11 and verse 7. Chapter 11, verse 7. "Come, let us go down and there confound the language." And again, the use of the plural pronoun, the use of God. For your notes, you can also mark down Isaiah chapter 6, verse 8. Isaiah chapter 6, verse 8. Another line of evidence is the use of plural adjectives. In most cases, when it's used of the true God, even in the plural form Elohim, the adjective that follows will be singular, unless it's the false gods. But now and then, used of the true God, the adjective that follows is also plural. Look at Joshua chapter 24. Joshua chapter 24. And verse 19, Joshua 24 and verse 19. It says, Joshua said unto the people, ye cannot serve Jehovah, for he is a holy God. And you anticipate in the Hebrew text for the word holy to be singular, but instead it's used in the plural. Literally, it reads, holy gods. Literally, holy gods. Obviously, Joshua did not hold two holy gods, only one holy God. Look at Psalm 149. Verse 2 says, Psalm 149, verse 2, let Israel rejoice in him that made him. But the word made is actually a plural form. Literally, this will rejoice in his makers, not maker. This will rejoice in his makers. Again, showing a concept of plurality. Let's go to Ecclesiastes chapter 12. Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes chapter 12. Verse 1, chapter 12, verse 1. Remember also your creator in the days of your youth. But in Hebrew, the word creator is plural. Remember, until the lily of the Hebrew reads, remember your creators in the days of your youth. Turn to Isaiah chapter 54. Isaiah chapter 54. Verse 5, Isaiah 54, verse 5, for your maker is your husband. Jehovah Hosts is his name, the only one of Israel is your redeemer. Notice the word maker and husband, both those words in Hebrew text are plurals. Literally it says, for your makers is your husbands. For your makers is your husbands. Again, that shows a concept of plurality in these different ways. So on one hand, you have the concept of plurality in the Godhead. But it's also a clear teaching, there is only one God. And the unity of the Godhead is clearly taught in Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 4. Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 4. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Jehovah our God, Jehovah is one. Now, this is the verse that rabbis like to use to dispute any concept of plurality within the Godhead. The Hebrew word is echad, E-C-H-A-D, E-C-H-A-D, which they insist has to mean an absolute one. But there's another Hebrew word that means absolute one, and that's the word yahid, Y-A-C-H-I-D, Y-A-C-H-I-D. It's not the word that Moses used. So if you use the word yahid, that would prove the case. God cannot be more than absolute oneness. We use a different word. And one way to show how that word is used is simply to go back to Genesis chapter 2. Genesis chapter 2. And verse 24. Genesis chapter 2, verse 24. Therefore shall a man leave his father and mother, shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be echad flesh. Same word used in Deuteronomy 6:4. And this verse clearly shows that the word echad can sometimes mean absolute oneness, but often it means a compound oneness, two individuals, a man and woman becoming one flesh. That's not an absolute oneness, it's a compound oneness. Other examples you can mark down will be Ezekiel chapter 37, verse 17. Ezekiel 37:17. Ezra chapter 2, verse 64. Ezra 2, verse 64. So we've seen the plurality, we've seen the unity, but how can we prove that the unity, plurality is limited to three? As we mentioned previously, in passages like Isaiah 42, Isaiah 61, never more than three are mentioned. Never more than three are mentioned. Let's look at two passages in Isaiah, and I'll save the best one second, but turn now to Isaiah chapter 63. Isaiah chapter 63. And notice three specific personalities involved in the Exodus event. The entire context is going to be verses 7 through 14. Verses 7 through 14. Notice one person in verse 7. I'll make mention of loving kindness of Jehovah and the praise of Jehovah according to all that Jehovah has bestowed on us and the great goodness he has brought forward to us, to the house of Israel, which had been bestowed upon them according to their mercies and according to their kindnesses. That's one person. Look at verse 9. In all their affliction he was afflicted, and the angel of his presence saved them. Here's a second personality, the angel of his presence. Elsewhere called simply the angel of Jehovah. We'll come back to that a bit later. You have a third personality, the Holy Spirit. Look at chapter verse 10. But they rebelled and grieved his Holy Spirit. Verse 11, they remember the days of old, Moses and his people. Where was he that brought them up from the sea with the shepherds of his flock? Where is he that put his Holy Spirit in the midst of them? And verse 14, as the cattle that go down into the valley, the Spirit of Jehovah caused them to rest. And three times you have the mention of the Holy Spirit, but you have only those three and no more. As far as the Hebrew Bible is concerned, the best single passage on the Trinity is Isaiah chapter 48. It's the best passage of them all. Isaiah chapter 48. The context is verses 12 through 16. Let's begin with verse 12 just to note what the context points out. Hearken unto me, Jacob, and Israel my called, I am he, I am the first, I am the last. Yea, my hand hath laid the foundation of the earth, my right hand hath spread out the heavens, and I called them together, they stand up together. Notice the speaker is clearly God, the one who created the heavens and the earth. The speaker has to be God. No one else is responsible for the existence of the universe. Now look at verse 16, the same speaker. Come ye near unto me, hear ye this. From the beginning I have not spoken in secret. From the time that it was, there am I. And now the Lord Jehovah hath sent me and the Spirit. The speaker is God. And now the speaker says, the Lord Jehovah hath sent me and the Spirit. Lord Jehovah, in this case, would be God the Father, the me, the speaker is God the Son, and the Spirit is God, the Holy Spirit. If in the Old Testament, this is your best single passage that will deal with the concept of a triune nature of the God of Israel. Let's talk about more specifically about the angel of Jehovah. Because this angel Jehovah appears frequently in the early centuries of Jewish history, less so in subsequent centuries. But in every passage where in the context he'd be mentioned to be God, to be mentioned the angel of God or the angel of Yahweh, somewhere in the same passage shall be called God or Yahweh, God or Jehovah. Look at Genesis chapter 16. The context involves verses 7 through 14. Genesis 16, verses 7 through 14. And in this context, he's four times called the angel of Jehovah. Verses 7, 9, 10, 11. 7, 9, 10, 11. But in verse 13, he's called Jehovah himself. Jehovah himself. Look at chapter 22. The context involves verses 9 through 13. 9 through 13. In verse 11 and verse 15, he's called the angel of Jehovah. Verse 11 and verse 15. But twice he's called Elohim or God in verse 12 and verse 16. Verse 12 and verse 16. Look at chapter 31. What you see here is in the context of verses 11 through 13. 11 through 13. In verse 11, he's called the angel of God, or the God. But in verse 13, he's called the God of Bethel. The God of Bethel. Look at chapter 32. In chapter 32, the context involves verses 24 through 30. 24 through 30. He wrestles with a man that turns out to be an angel in verse 24. But in verse 28, he says, "You're striven with God." And in verse 30, he says, "I've seen God face to face." He recognizes he wrestled with God himself. Look at Judges chapter 6. Well, before that, let's go to Exodus chapter 3. Exodus chapter 3. The context is verses 1 through 5. And in verse 2, he's referred to as the angel of Jehovah, as being in the bush. But in verse 4, he's called Jehovah and God in the bush. That's true for every context. He may be called the angel of God, angel of Jehovah, being called God himself and Jehovah himself. Now let's go to Judges chapter 6. The context is found in verses 11 through 24. 11 through 24. He's called the angel of Jehovah in verses 11, 12, 20, and 21. 11, 12, 20, and 21. But then he's called Jehovah himself in verses 14, 16, 22, 23. 14, 16, 22, 23. Look at Judges 13. The context involves verses 2 through 24. Verses 2 through 24. And nine times in this passage, he's called the angel of Jehovah, nine specific times. But in verse 22, he's referred to as God. We saw God's face. And what a point is in verse 18, his name is Wonderful. As we saw from our study of Isaiah chapter 9 yesterday, the word wonderful, pele, is only used of what God is or does. So from all these examples, the angel of Jehovah is not a common, ordinary angel. He's one of the ways the second member of the Trinity has appeared. Now we saw yesterday, Isaiah chapter 42, verse 8. 42, verse 8, God says, I am Yahweh, Jehovah, that is my name. I will not give my glory to another. Remember that passage? I am Yahweh, Jehovah, that is my name. I will not give my glory to another. Now keep that in mind and look at Exodus chapter 23. And we see the uniqueness of the angel of Jehovah. Exodus chapter 23. Verse 20, Behold, I send an angel before you to keep you by the way and to bring you into the place which I have prepared. Take ye heed before him, hearken unto his voice, provoke him not, for he will not pardon your transgression, for my name is in him. For my name is in him. And for this angel to have God's name means he has to be God himself. So in verse 20, notice he is the angel that led them through the wilderness wanderings. And in verse 21, they warned not that he is to be obeyed and not to be provoked for two reasons in verse 21. Number one, he will not forgive the sin of rebellion. So this angel has the authority to forgive sins. He has to be more than a common angel. And then even more crucial, my name is in him. He's got the name Yahweh. So in verse 22, there'll be blessings for obedience. In verse 23, he's the angel of the Exodus. And Hosea makes a reference to this passage in Hosea chapter 12, verses 3 through 5. Hosea 12, verses 3 through 5, this angel has God's name. And one last thing, the Spirit of Jehovah. And the Spirit is quite active from the beginning to the end of the biblical record. And he's not just an influence, he's not just a force, he's a distinct personality. Act begins activity in Genesis chapter 1, verse 2, the Spirit of God brooded upon the face of the waters. Is mentioned frequently throughout the Hebrew Bible into the New Testament. He's mentioned the first book, Genesis, in the first chapter. He's mentioned again the very last chapter of the Revelation. So these are additional added information to what we covered about the first coming prophecies. We'll take a break, and then we'll deal with the questions. And we'll hold these questions until the break is over.